Thank you very much. Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of the oscillatory program for having me here. In this case, the one organizer who is present at the moment, and I'm looking forward to my future and longer visit to the same program. Okay, actually, as you see, this is based on joint work mainly with Wei Zhu Bao from the National University of Singapore, who incidentally will also be a visitor to this program later this year, I suppose. And actually there is, I should say that this talk is based on quite a number of papers which were co-authored by various combinations of all these people involved here. In particular, let me mention Dieter Jaksch, who is an Austrian physicist, but now he's actually in the physics department at Oxford University. Okay, the purpose of this talk is to give you a roller coaster ride through some of the recent results and numerical and analytical results on simulations of Bose-Einstein condensation. So let me give you an outline first of all. Well, I'll begin with a physical motivation of what we are doing and why we are doing this and this. And I have to warn you to start with, this is going to be based on very pedestrian physics. I'll talk about the physical experiments involved in Bose-Einstein condensation, and then I'll turn to the mathematics, in particular to what I consider the most important model for Bose-Einstein condensation, that is the Gross-Pitayevsky Schrödinger equation. Then we shall deal with various issues involving this equation, in particular with ground states, which is a special kind of stationary solution. Then I'll also talk about dynamics of Bose-Einstein condensates, and of course future challenges in the field, which in my view there's plenty of. Okay, motivation. What is a Bose-Einstein condensate? When the temperature gets cold, and at this point I'm not going to specify what I mean by cold, but in any case, when the temperature gets low, atoms in general behave more like waves and less like particles. Okay, keep in mind wave-matter duality. So when the temperature goes down, you have to more think of particles in terms of waves. Now, when the temperature gets down even more, atoms in some sense begin to overlap with each other. When it gets extremely cold, and what do I mean by extremely cold? Here I can be more precise. What I mean by extremely cold is I'm talking about the nano-Kelvin range, nano-Kelvin temperature range. So here we're talking really of temperatures which are many orders of magnitude lower than the temperature of the outer universe, just to give you a feeling of what we're talking about. Then most atoms, say in a gas, behave completely in the same way, and in fact they coalesce into the quantum mechanical ground state. And they form what some people refer to as a superatom. So all in all, you can think of a Bose-Einstein condensate as a new state of matter. When I went to high school, in high school physics, I was taught gases, fluids, and solids. And now there's a new kid on the block, which is the Bose-Einstein condensate. Actually, now there's another one, which is the Mott insulator, but let me not talk about this at the moment. So historically speaking, originally, the Indian physicist Bose had this idea in the year 1925 that something like what we call now a Bose-Einstein condensate has to exist at very low temperatures. And if I was told correctly, he wrote a paper which then was circulated to Albert Einstein, who understood that what is really going on here is a phase transition. This, of course, explains the name of the Bose-Einstein distribution, which is all over this theory. So anyway, this was 1925. But of course, in 1925, there was absolutely no way of creating these low temperatures in a laboratory. So it really took quite a while, in particular about 70 years, until the first successful experiment happened. So the first experimental realization of the Bose-Einstein condensate was reported by the Chila lab in Colorado, Chila Physics Lab in Colorado, in the year 95. Since then, there is many improved experiments. Nowadays, well, I wouldn't say that you can cook a Bose-Einstein condensate in your kitchen at home, but I mean, it can be done at many physics labs in the world. So I was fortunate enough to see one in Innsbruck like 1 month ago or so. And for them, it's really a standard thing. So when I talked to these people, they just walked me into the lab, and the professor said to his assistants, well, show him a condensate forming. And they did it. So, I mean, it's still very, very high-tech physics, but it can be done in many labs all over the world. Now, why do we need mathematics for this? Well, for many reasons. First of all, there is very interesting mathematical models involved. For example, the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, which is what I will concentrate about in my talk. Gross-Pitayevsky equation, let me just say one word at the moment, is kind of a mean field theory for Bose-Einstein condensate. Then a very interesting issue is the process of condensation itself. So the cooling process of the Bose gas, and typically what we use there is a so-called quantum Boltzmann master equation, which has certain similarities to the Boltzmann equation of fluid dynamics, but other features which are completely different. And actually, in particular here, there is a lot of mathematical challenges on all levels, that is, on analytical levels, on numerical levels, and modeling-wise. This is still a very, very open field. And then, of course, there is the coupling of these two models, because never in reality we can have what is called a pure condensate. The pure condensate could only exist at zero temperature. Yeah? So at anything larger than zero temperature, there is going to be some particles which are in the condensate and some particles which are out of the condensate. And actually what you would need is a coupling of these equations, and recently there have been first attempts in this direction. Also, there is, well, numerical simulations, of course, but why do we need numerical simulations? Well, first of all, this is a really interesting, from my point of view, this is a really interesting proving ground for developing and analyzing and testing new numerical techniques. But from a practical point of view, from the point of view of the physicists, what they want is they want us to help them in guiding new experiments and predicting the outcome. And in some cases, in interpreting the outcome of experiments which they had already done. Okay, so this is the main reason why we do numerical simulation of Bose-Einstein condensates. Okay, physically, what happens is, as I already said, a phase transition. So what you see here is a plot of the temperature over the density, actually, if you want logarithmic scale. And, up there, you would have like a vapor, if the temperature is sufficiently large. Then in this range, which is lower temperature but high densities, you would talk about condensed matter physics, which is quite a classical field of physics by now. If you think of liquid helium, that would be somewhere here in this diagram, and this is the range of temperature density where you have a Bose-Einstein condensate. And here's the forbidden band, which makes for the phase transition. So what does that mean? Well, what you can read from this diagram is that, first of all, in order to make a Bose-Einstein condensate, you need sufficiently low temperature. You need to be below threshold. But, I mean, the reasonable temperature ranges that can be produced nowadays, they're somewhere here. So this tells you that you also need a sufficiently high density in order to create a condensate. And this, again, implies in the laboratory that you have to put some confinement to your gas of bosons. And this will then show up in the mathematical modeling. Okay, here you see experimental results, and this is, and when I mean experimental, when I say experimental, I really mean it. So this is not plots of numerical simulations. What you see here is the momentum density of the Bose gas. So you see here at temperatures which decrease, so you see that here there are quite some particles which have low energy, which have which kind of start to accumulate at zero momentum. Then the accumulation goes on when you decrease the temperature, and then this is what people produced in the year 95. So actually, what would be an ideal Bose-Einstein condensate? Well, it would be a delta distribution centered at momentum equals zero. This we cannot do. Yeah? But what we can do now is we can do much better experiments. So we can sort of approximate the delta distribution in momentum space in a much better way. Yeah? Well, the mathematical modeling. So for the mathematical modeling in the mean field theory, we of course need some physical assumptions. So the main assumptions that I'm going to make is that I'm assuming that I'm at zero temperature, and I shall assume that my atoms in the Bose, in the gas of bosons, yeah, say number n atoms, are in total chaos. And total chaos in mathematical terms means that the wave function, the n particle wave function, is a product of single particle wave functions. Okay, and when you go, yeah, then there's another assumption, which means that the density of the gas is not too large. Further assumption is that the interatomic interaction is of two-body form, so I'm excluding at the moment three and more body interactions, and it's an elastic interaction, and then I shall assume that the interaction potential is in Fermi form, and I shall tell you in a moment what this is. In any case, when you make these assumptions and you plug them into the many-body Hamiltonian, then you can derive an equation for this function here, for the single-body wave function. And after some approximations, what comes out is, of course, the well-known Gross-Pitayevsky equation. Now, when you hear Gross-Pitayevsky, you have to think of a non-linear Schrödinger equation, which is then given here. Well, the left-hand side is the usual left-hand side of the Schrödinger equation. I wrote the right-hand side as the derivative of the Hamiltonian functional with respect to the conjugate of the wave function. And so it's important to look at the Hamiltonian functional, and this you see here. So you see it consists of a couple of terms. Well, the first term is the usual, if you want, diffusion term in the Schrödinger equation. The second term, consisting of this, actually this is a multiplication operator of an external potential V multiplied by the wave function, and V, you have to think of it as a quadratic confinement potential, which comes from, say, laser confining the condensate, or from magnetic confinement of the condensate. So when you see V, think of it for the moment as x squared half or something with some scaling. And then this is maybe the most important term that we have in the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. This is a nonlinear term which represents the interaction of the bosons. And let me say at this point that interaction can be of two kinds. It can be attractive or repulsive. Now, I have to tell you what this interaction potential is. And the assumption that I already mentioned is Fermi form, which means that particles only interact if they are in the same location, which means then in mathematical terms that the interaction potential is a delta distribution, well, multiplied by some scaling factors. Okay. So now this is the Hamiltonian form of the equation. Well, when you write it in, if you want, in strong form, what you get is the so-called three-dimensional Gross-Pitayevsky nonlinear Schrödinger equation. So again, the usual left-hand side of the Schrödinger equation, the diffusion term, the multiplication operator of the external potential multiplied by the wave function, and the nonlinear interaction term, which is cubic. Now, again, as I said, V of x has to be thought of a harmonic trapping potential. Well, to be more precise than I was before, what I mean by a harmonic trapping potential is, of course, a quadratic function in the space variables, but there can be some frequencies. And it's actually important that we admit different frequencies in all the three directions. Yeah, maybe what I didn't say yet is that this function psi, which is the solution of the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, is a macroscopic wave function. So it's the wave function of the whole condensate. That means it lives in three-dimensional space, plus time, of course.
Okay, it's a complex valued function in general, which lives in three-dimensional position space plus time. Yeah, and then we have a normalization condition, which is typical, of course, which is mass conservation, if you want. And the normalization condition here is that the L2 norm of the wave function is conserved in time. This is, of course, maintained by the equation. Well, there is some scale. Well, mathematicians always like to do scaling. When you do numerics, you really then appreciate the effect of scaling. So we have to introduce dimensionless variables. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of this. In the end, what comes out, if you do it correctly, is a, if you want, three-parameter problem. One parameter is this parameter beta, which I'm going to call the interaction parameter in the sequel, which multiplies the nonlinearity. So you have to think of beta as measuring the strength of the atomic interactions. Okay? And let me point out to you that beta can be positive or negative, depending on the kind of condensate which you have in front of you. Now, I said three parameters, so we need two more. Well, the other parameters occur in the trapping potential. After appropriate scaling, we made two out of three frequencies. So these are the scaled frequency by assuming that I use the frequency in the x direction as a scaling parameter. Okay, so now you have a three-parameter nonlinear Schrödinger equation to play with. Now, just to give you an idea of parameters, well, the most important, as I said, is maybe this parameter beta here. Let me tell you what happens in practical situations. For the Gila condensate, which was produced in 1995, beta is of the order of magnitude of 0.02 times the number of particles. If I remember correctly, this condensate consisted of something like 20 or 30,000 atoms. So actually, this is quite a substantial number. Now, in more recent experiments, like in this MIT experiment, the number of particles can be up to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 million particles in the condensate. So that means, in general, you have to think of beta as a large parameter, and this is actually the most interesting regime. In physical terms, this is called the Thomas-Fermi regimes. In mathematical terms, this is called the semi-classical regimes. You come from the one to the other by a simple rescaling of the equation. So think of beta as large. Okay, there's an important issue involved with the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, which is completely different to what you have in, say, fluid dynamics. In fluid dynamics, when you think of a two or one dimensional, say, a two-dimensional flow situation, what you can do with an Navier-Stokes equation is just you drop the third coordinate and the third component of the velocity field, and you reduced your system to a reasonable functioning two-dimensional model. Now, this is not the case for the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. The nonlinearity really couples all the coordinates. So if you want to think of a lower dimensional situation, you have to do something much more sophisticated than just drop a coordinate. Okay? And this is, I have to say, this is not the case for the linear Schrödinger equation, of course, because the linear Schrödinger equation maintains factorization of the wave function. The nonlinear equation does not. Now, physicists, however, like to produce lower dimensional condensates. Now, how is this done? Well, typically, a reduction to, say, two dimensions, which physicists then call a disk-shaped condensation, is done experimentally by choosing, say, the x and y trapping frequencies of the harmonic potentials of the same order of magnitude, of order one, say, by choosing a large trapping frequency in the third direction. So they kind of make the whole condensate collapse in the z equals zero plane. Now, mathematically, this, of course, after my scaling, corresponds to the game where one of these parameters, say gamma y, is of the order of one, but gamma z is large. Now, I need a physical assumption on the wave function to go ahead. And the physical assumption is, well, that due to the large confinement in the c direction, we assume that there are no excitations in the c direction. Now that means basically that I assume that my three-dimensional wave function is the product of a two-dimensional wave function times a shape function. And I have to tell you what the shape function is. Well, typically as a shape function, what is used, and this is actually good mathematical reason, is the ground state of the harmonic oscillator in C direction, which is just the Gaussian. Okay, now when you take this ansatz for the wave function, for the three-dimensional wave function, plug it into the three-dimensional Grotzky-Tayevsky equation, you will see that this ansatz does not satisfy the equation. So you have to do something in terms of best approximation. Well, a way of doing this is projection. So you project the equation on the space of such wave functions. And when you do this, what you end up with is, well, you end up with a two-dimensional Grotzky-Tayevsky equation, which almost looks like as if you only had to cancel one coordinate, but not quite. You see that effective interaction parameter has changed. Okay, and essentially changed by multiplying the old one by the square root of the scaled excitation frequency in C direction. Okay, now if you, well, you can of course go on with this, you can produce what physicists call a Seeger-shaped condensate, that means a mathematical term, reduction to one dimension, that means two trapping frequencies are large. Now, again, you play the same game. You assume now that this three-dimensional wave function is a one-dimensional wave function multiplied by a shape function used for the shape function. Again, the ground state of the harmonic oscillator in z and y direction. Project the equation onto this space, and what you end up with is the one-dimensional Grotzky-Tayevsky equation. Again, you record a change of the interaction parameter. Now, this actually sounded very simple. It's a very simple mathematical procedure. If you want to prove it, it's actually quite difficult. And a thesis of a student of mine was just finished a couple of months ago when she defended her PhD. Radha Weishaupt, she defended her PhD last week, and she exactly did this work. So she proved that this projection approximation is valid in a certain range of parameters. One important ingredient for the proof was Arnold's theory of oscillatory dynamical systems, which has a nice version in infinitely many dimensions. In any case, this leads us to the general form of the Grotzky-Tayevsky equation, which is, again, a cubically nonlinear Schrödinger equation with a quadratic confinement potential, and these parameters depend on dimension. Okay? And keep in mind we have this normalization condition, which of course is maintained by the equation. I already said that there is two kinds of important cases, two important cases, that is two kinds of interaction. One is a repulsive interaction of particles, which leads to a defocusing cubically nonlinear Schrödinger equation. The other one is, miraculously, physicists can produce an attractive condensate, which then leads to a focusing Schrödinger equation. And actually, they can, even more miraculously, for me, they can switch from one to the other by using so-called Feshbach resonances in the condensate. Now, mathematically speaking, we have two extreme regimes. One extreme regime is a weakly interacting condensate. And the weakly interacting condensate refers to the fact that the interaction parameter, the absolute value of the interaction parameter, is small, much less than one. In mathematical terms, this is not really the most interesting case, because what we are facing here is a perturbation of the harmonic oscillator. Small perturbation of the harmonic oscillator. Although this is a sort of an exaggeration, there is still important mathematical aspects of this regime. But more interesting, at least to me, is the semi-classical regime, or in physical terms, the Thomas Fermi regime, which has strongly repulsively interacting particles, which means that the interaction parameter is positive and very large. Okay. So now, what are the conserved quantities in the Gross-Pytajewski equation? Well, of course, as I already said, the normalization condition of the wave function, which is the L2 norm, is conserved. This you can think of it as conservation of mass. There is also conservation of energy. Well, what is the energy for the Gross-Pytajewski equation? Well, there is the kinetic energy. There is the external potential energy, which is induced by the laser or magnetic confinement of the condensate. And there is the interaction energy term. Now, and this is a conserved, and the integral is a conserved quantity. Now, there's another important quantity involved, which is not a conserved one, but it's important nevertheless, and there's the so-called chemical potential. Now, I'm going to tell you very soon what the chemical potential is all about. At the moment, let me just say that it's almost identical to the energy. The first two terms are identical. The third one differs by a factor of 1/2. Okay, and there's a good reason for this, and I'll get to that. Okay, I personally like the semi-classical regime of the Schrödinger equation, so I need to tell you how one gets from the Thomas Fermi regime to the semi-classical one. That's actually easy. Thomas Fermi regime means the interaction parameter beta d is large. Let me rename, or let me introduce a new parameter, which I call epsilon. And epsilon is just 1 over some power, which is the appropriate power, of course, dimension dependent, of the interaction parameter. And let me rewrite the equation in terms of this new parameter. Then what you find is just a semi-classically rescaled Schrödinger equation. That means you get an epsilon in front of the time derivative, and you get an epsilon square in front of the Laplacian. And the other terms have coefficients 1. Now, that means you can do quantum hydrodynamics. In particular, well, quantum hydrodynamics, what is it really? Is writing the wave function in WKB form, assuming that, making the ansatz that the phase has order of magnitude 1 over epsilon. Now, plug this into the Schrödinger equation, separate real and imaginary parts. What you find is this coupled system of equations here. Well, the first equation you see is the transport equation, where transport is affected by this velocity, which is just the gradient of the phase. The second equation, well, the left-hand side looks very classical in fluid dynamics at least, is like the isotropic compressible Euler equation with a quadratic pressure density relationship. And the right-hand side is pretty complicated. It's nonlinear and third order, so it carries the dispersive effects which are inherent to the Schrödinger equation. The interesting thing is this term here carries a parameter epsilon square in front. So you, of course, might be tempted to drop this, but then there is a whole theory of when you can do this and when you cannot do this. Okay, this is quantum hydrodynamics. So what we end up is collecting facts at a dispersively regularized isotropic Euler system with a quadratic pressure density constitutive relation. This, let me point out to you, this of course comes from the cubic nonlinearity of the Schrödinger equation. Okay, well, when we speak about Schrödinger equations, we have to speak about stationary solutions, and in particular about ground states. Now, what do I mean by a stationary solution of the Schrödinger equation? Well, clearly it's not enough to just drop the time derivative on the left-hand side. We can do much better. That is, we can look for a time periodic wave functions. Now, what does that mean? If you consider then corresponding observables, which are quadratic in the wave function, they of course would be independent of time. Yeah. Now, when you make this ansatz, or when you look for such solutions, that means you plug this ansatz into the Schrödinger equation, what you find, and compute an equation for phi, what you find is, of course, this nonlinear eigenvalue problem for the Hamiltonian operator, for the nonlinear Hamiltonian operator. But what you have, of course, to maintain is a constraint. So you have a nonlinear eigenvalue problem with a constraint. Now there is, of course, another important fact is, remember when I told you about the chemical potential, easy computation shows that the eigenvalue is simply the chemical potential associated to this wave function phi. So there is this connection between the eigenvalue and the energy. They are not equal. There is this term here which makes them different. That's quite important, actually. Again, for the linear case, they are equal. Energy is eigenvalue, right? Because this term drops out. Okay. Well, how do we find eigenfunctions? Well, of course, any eigenfunction is a critical point of the energy function under the constraint. In other words, you can view the nonlinear eigenvalue problem with the Euler-Lagrange equations of the energy function under the constraint. Okay? Now, well, in the linear case, at least you can compute all the eigenfunctions and all the eigenvalues, and you can order them. You can order them according to energies. Now, in the linear case, ordering them according to energies is, of course, equivalent to ordering them according to chemical potentials. For the nonlinear case, these orderings may very well be different. Actually, I believe that they are not, but I have not seen a proof yet. Okay, so this is still an open question here. Now, what is the ground state? The ground state is defined as the minimizer of the energy function under the L2 constraint. Now, it has been shown, the other explanation is that you can think of it as the eigenfunction of the nonlinear eigenvalue problem with minimum energy among all eigenfunctions. Exactly the same characterization. There has been given a proof of existence and uniqueness of a positive ground state, because there is no uniqueness because you can allow phase shifts. There's no general uniqueness, but there is uniqueness of a positive solution, which is in a paper by Lieb, Seiringer, and Ingvarsson of the year 2000. There is many open questions involved with the excited states. We don't really have a good idea yet of what they look like and so on. Okay, I promised numerics. So numerical method for the ground state solution. Well, one, of course, is an imaginary time. Well, the method that you might think of immediately is an imaginary time method, which basically means that turn around or cancel the I in front of the time derivative of the Schrödinger equation, change the sign, and you get a hyperbolic equation, which is, of course, some kind of gradient flow type method. There's one big problem involved here, and that is you have to keep the constraint. And the gradient flow associated to the Hamiltonian does not keep the L2 constraint. So you have to work on this. Of course, another method is directly minimizing the energy functional by, say, finite elements or something. Imaginary time method, well, a way of doing, of keeping the constraint would be, and this is actually what we have used quite successfully, is just think of the gradient flow and do the gradient flow on a short time interval and then renormalize and then keep going like this. This is a way of artificially, in some sense, imposing the L2 constraint. For the linear case, there is actually it's easy to prove that energy is decaying if you do this. For a nonlinear case with a small time step, we do not yet have an approximation result. Another way is to introduce or to enforce the normalization by a penalty term. In some sense, this corresponds to letting delta t tend to zero in the method that I showed you previously. This method actually is energy diminishing actually in the nonlinear case. So this is the classical way of computing the ground states and the eigenfunction. Let me tell you that the real difficulty here when you do numerical computations is choosing appropriate initial data which guarantee convergence to the right excited state. Okay, this is the main problem that we are facing here. Okay. Yeah, let me just point out to you one simple fact. in our asymptotic regimes. Well, in the weak interaction regime, when beta is small, you might just be tempted of dropping the nonlinear term, and what you end up with is an approximation of the ground state given by the Gaussian in, say, here in one dimension. But this is dimension independent, of course. Not so interesting. Much more interesting is when you have strongly repulsive interaction, when beta is large. Then when you look at the ground state problem, at least, you can convince yourself rather easily that diffusion is not really very important in this regime. And this is something that physicists have known for a long time. So you drop diffusion, and what you end up with is an algebraic equation for the ground state. And you can solve this algebraic equation, and what you find is basically a function which looks like this. And this is called the Thomas Fermi approximation of the ground state. And we have all kinds of theorems which show that this Thomas Fermi approximation is actually a good approximation in this regime. Okay, let me show you a few numerical results. Let me show you, well, the simplest case may be a harmonic oscillator. Where's the mouse? Okay, now, well, this is the ground state for a fixed beta. Well, this is just the Gaussian. And now what I do is I turn on beta. Let me turn on beta for you. And then what you see is that this Gaussian slowly moves into precisely this Thomas Fermi ground state that I've shown you here. Okay, let me show you another interesting example that is an optical lattice potential. What physicists do in optical lattices is they take their quadratic confinement potential and they superimpose a periodic potential. Yeah? And then when you compute the ground state, now I compute the ground state for some beta, what you see is, well, you see some oscillations appear here, but basically the shape more or less is the shape of the Gaussian. Now let me turn on beta, and what you see is more and more oscillations occur, and slowly with increasing beta, then you end up in the highly oscillatory regime. And this is actually a fact that physicists try to use in quantum information theory. They kind of want to localize one atom in a well. And then the fact whether there would be an atom would be a qubit, and if there's no atom, would be qubit zero. Okay, so yeah, this is actually one of the applications that physicists refer to in Bose-Einstein condensation. Okay, let me speak about something else, that is superfluid experiments. Well, a Bose-Einstein condensate is a superfluid. This has been proven experimentally. And actually, in the modeling, you see that, of course, there is a very, very close similarity to Ginzburg-Lambda, although there is differences. In Ginzburg-Lambda, you are talking of wave functions which converge to one. In the far field, in Bose-Einstein condensation, you have confinement instead. So it's a different world. But never mind. What we can do is we can do vortex experiments. That means take a condensate and rotate it, say, around the z-axis. So what you have to do mathematically then is you have to add this term to the Schrödinger equation, or to the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, where you have to think of omega as the angular velocity rotating around the z-axis. Now, let me show you what happens. Now, compute the ground state, and this is now in an isotropic trap. And what I do now is, here is beta equal, no, excuse me, omega angular velocity equals zero, and now I turn on angular velocity. And coordinate-wise, I'm now in the rotating frame. Well, this is boring. Nothing happened. Maybe the movie doesn't work, but let's wait for a while. I turn on velocity, turn on, and now you see a vortex appear. You see this vortex appears, velocity is increasing, and suddenly what you see is a break of symmetry. And this is a classical phenomenon which happens in superfluidity. You see this batch of vortices arrange itself, and then when you increase the velocity, you can only do this up to a certain bound, because beyond the bound no ground state exists, you get an arrangement of vortices. Actually, we can compute now maybe 200 or 300 of those. In an anisotropic trap, the same experiment, You see the condensate is anisotropic, it's more elongated in this direction. So you see a vortex appears here. Frequency, velocity is increased. And then the vortices then start to arrange in the line. Okay, so there is all these fascinating self-organizational properties of the superfluid. This, of course, was 2D experiments. For vortices in 3D, we have to think of vortex lines. Let me show you a level set of the ground state. This is for zero velocity. You see no vortex appear. You increase velocity, still no vortex appears. You increase, suddenly one vortex appears. Rotational symmetry is kept. You increase velocity, you lose rotational symmetry. This is very, very classical. And there is actually papers to prove this fact. Oops, where is the mouse? Okay. Let me skip this due to... Let me say a few words about the time-dependent Gross-Pitayevsky equation. So here you see the time-dependent Gross-Pitayevsky equation in D dimension, as I've written it down before. Now, what are the physically interesting cases? Well, I mean, I said in the beginning that a Bose-Einstein condensate is in the quantum mechanical ground state. So why do I have to look at time-dependent equations and solutions? Well, one reason is that I can start from a ground state solution. I can introduce a perturbation to the system, and I can wait, or I can check how it moves into another ground state. And this is done, of course, by time-dependent simulation of the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. Now, one way of doing this is changing the trapping frequency. This can be done by turning a switch in the lab. Another way of doing this is changing the interaction parameter. That means change the number of atoms in the condensate. And finally, there is a very important issue, that is vortex dynamics. Okay. So numerical methods, this is the method that we use and that we have analyzed, and that's a very simple time-splitting spectral method. It's just the usual thing what you would do for the Schrödinger equation, so just split into two equations, take the, if you want, diffusive or dispersive term first, and then collect the nonlinearity and the external potential. The nice feature about this equation is that it maintains the absolute value of the wave function in this time step. So you can think of this as an ODE for the phase, for example. Okay. The interesting fact is that we have a very clear analysis for how this method behaves, in particular for how it behaves in the semi-classical limit. Yeah, but I didn't say how you solve this equation. Well, one way of doing this is, of course, by trigonometric spectral method, or another one by the Laguerre-Hermite functions. This is what we have been using. But you can think of many things here. What are the properties of this method? Well, one is as an explicit method. This is very important when you do dispersive equations. It's time-reversible and unconditionally stable. Other important facts, but there's just one that I want to mention. This is the time transverse invariance. And this is something that no finite difference method will give you. What does that mean? It means that when you change the potential by adding a constant, of course the wave function is then modulated by a phase factor, but the observables, in particular the density, remains unchanged. Okay, and this is actually very, very fundamental in the numerical solution of Schrödinger equations in semi-classical regimes. And as I said, no finite difference method will ever give you this. Well, then there is an optimal resolution of the equation, which sort of is hard to beat in terms of the interaction parameter, which I'm not going to go into at the moment. Okay, let me show you a few. I think I have 5 more minutes. Is that correct?
No, you can go on for 15 minutes.
I can. Okay. Okay. No. That's okay. Let me show you a few numerical results. So the first one is a simple 1D simulation of a repulsive Bose-Einstein condensate. What I do here is, at time t equals 0, I change the trapping frequency by just multiplying it by a factor of 4. So this means, of course, the old ground state is not going to be the new anymore. So the system will move out of the ground state, and let's see what it does. Well, my firewall asks me a question. Okay, so what you see here is that the common state begins to wobble, and then suddenly it starts to develop some dispersive oscillations are close to the center of the trap, which then get wilder and wilder, of course. So this was a very simple simulation. Let me show you 2D. 2D is, of course, very interesting because you have the focusing, defocusing regime, and two dimensions for the cubically nonlinear Schrödinger equation is precisely threshold. It's a threshold case. So what does that mean? That means essentially if initial energy is positive, you can count on the fact that there is a global solution, there's no blow up in finite time. If initial energy is negative, you will have blow up in finite time. So here I show you a focusing simulation first with a blow up. Well, what I do is at time t equals 0, again I change, well now I don't change the trapping frequency, I change the interaction parameter. I go from plus 40 to minus 50. So I make the originally repulsive condensate attractive. Okay, and let me show you the simulation. Again, the nice firewall. So what you see is the accumulation of particles close to the center of the trap. And then what you see, well, here, of course, you see the density. And then the density is starting to form a delta peak, which then is realized at the blow-up time. Yeah. And then, of course, the simulation doesn't make any sense anymore. A defocusing simulation in two dimensions, well, what happens here is basically what we do is, again, we change the trapping frequencies by just multiplying them with a factor of 2. And here we are in an anisotropic situation. And what you see is this is a phenomenon which has been observed in the laboratory, that due to anisotropy, the condensate is rotating in the trap during its process of rearranging into a new ground state. And then in the end of this simulation, it also develops some dispersive oscillations. No, not really. That was later on. In the center, close to the center of the trap. Now let me say a few words about a very interesting simulation. And that is actually based on an experiment which was again done in the Gila lab in Colorado in the year 2001, if I remember correctly. And this is in the physical literature, this is referred to as the experiment on collapse and explosion of BEC. Now, what did the physicists do? They started out with an with a repulsive condensate, and using Feshbach resonances, changed the interaction length at a certain time to make it negative. So, in mathematical terms, the very similar to what I've shown you before, the repulsive Schrödinger equation suddenly turns into an attractive one. Okay. Now, what happens in the experiment is really that there is some kind of memory effect in the condensate, the memory of the state of the repulsive state. And a full collapse is not realized, but the collapse event, the first collapse event, is hindered by an explosion event right afterwards. So explosion means that particles which accumulate close to the center of the trap suddenly are thrown out of the center of the trap. Okay? And then the system relaxes again very soon. Afterwards, it restarts. It retries the collapse. Still doesn't manage due to explosion. And this is a sequence, I wouldn't say periodic, but this is a sequence of reoccurring events. Okay? This has been observed in the lab. And the idea of the physicists is that the reason for what they see is that suddenly, that in this experiment, not only two-body forces come into play, but also what is called three-body recombination. And three-body recombination is, in mathematical terms, modeled by modifying the cubically nonlinear Schrödinger equation, which would be this one, by a fifth-order polynomial term, but this term has an I in front. So it means it acts as relaxation to the equation. So in mathematical terms, what you have in front of you is a competition of these two terms. One of them tries to do collapse, the other one does explosion. And actually in mathematical terms, and this is a well-known fact, this term wins here due to dimensionality and orders in the exponents. Okay. Now what you see, and this is actually a simulation which we have done in 3D, and this has turned out to be quite complicated, so you have to think of the code which runs really for a couple of days. Yeah, maybe I should before say something about the experimental setup. So I'm now discussing this regime here, where here I plot time over, I plot interaction parameter over time. So here you are in the repulsive regime, suddenly it's turned off, and the collapse starts here. Okay? And this is other physical mechanisms which I'm not going to describe in this talk. So let me just show you what the central density does. So actually this plot here is the central density of the condensate. So you see, first of all, it decays, then suddenly, this is the central density, the dotted line. So first of all, here you see the first attempt of explosion, of collapse, which is then hindered by explosion. Then you have a relaxation. The relaxation goes on here. Suddenly the condensate tries another collapse event, which is again hindered by explosion, and so on. And then later on, the condensate relaxes to a rest state. So the interesting thing is, and this is what the physicists were really surprised about, that this model is pretty accurate in the sense that we compared to four sets of experiments, and we only had to fit one parameter which was valid for all sets of experiments. And this was pretty impressive to us, and I hope to the physicists also. So this is an indication that the real reason for what they observed is this three-body recombination term. Of course, it's not the proof, but it's the best thing you can expect. Let me show you the movie of the condensate. So you see that the condensate, first of all, starts with a collapse. Again, the collapse is hindered by explosions. The relaxation, now there is partial collapses, explosions all over the game, and then later on the condensate starts to relax into some new ground state. You see this successively occurring collapse explosion events. Okay. I'm going to skip the two component BEC. And let me just say a few words about vortex dynamics. Vortices in general means that I'm interested in solutions, or the analysis of vortices means that I'm interested in the solution of the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, which again could be periodic in time. But then it's a function, say, here in the central vortex state. It's a radial function multiplied by this phase here. And in this phase, you see a number m appearing. And m is just the winding number of the vortex, which is here located, say, at r equals 0. What is the winding number? It just tells you how often the fluid swirls around the vortex. The quantum fluid swirls around the vortex. So if you put this answer into the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, again, what you find is a nonlinear eigenvalue problem here in one radial variable, of course, subject to a constraint. So first of all, we have to study this eigenvalue problem, and then we can talk about vortex dynamics. What do I mean by vortex dynamics? Well, there is two ways of changing the vortex structure. One is checking for dynamical stability. That means I take the confinement potential and I perturb it. And I just see what happens to the vortex, how it moves. Well, the second is I consider interaction of vortices. And that means basically I move, say, two or three vortices out of the center of the trap. and I make them interact by just taking the product of the wave function, of course normalized in L2, as an initial function for the Schrödinger simulation. Okay, and when I do this, let me just show you what happens here. Now, the first movie that I'm going to show you is on dynamical stability on a vortex with winding number 1, m equal 1. Let me show you the velocity field. So here you see the center of the trap would be somewhere here, and I move the vortex out of the center. No, excuse me, I was wrong. No, I didn't move. The vortex is in the center of the trap, but the potential has been perturbed. Okay? Now I'm going to show you what happens in the perturbation. Well, not really much. You have this one vortex which keeps its winding direction and just moves according to the perturbation. So that's very unspectacular. Well, this is winding number 1. And if you do the same experiment for winding number 2, checking dynamical stability, what you see is that immediately this one vortex of winding number 2 splits into two vortices. So actually, you can prove that all winding numbers larger than 1 are unstable with respect to perturbations of the potential. Let me go to the interaction of vortices. So here I have one vortex, and let me show you, one vortex which has been moved out of the center of the trap. And then it starts to move, of course. And let me show you. So you see the center of the trap would be here in the middle of the picture, and I just move this vortex out, and now I run the simulation. Well, the vortex basically starts to move towards the center, then out of it, and back, and so on. And this is actually a situation, one vortex, which you can solve precisely. You can write an ODE for the center of the vortex, okay, if you have only one. Okay, it gets, of course, much more interesting when you have, say, two vortices. Here I have two vortices. They interact. Both have been moved out of the center of the trap. So what you see is basically that they move in rather complicated trajectories. Okay, and then, well, I'm not going to show you the three examples. Let me just say, finally, in the last half minute, let me give you an idea on future challenges. Well, I skipped multi-component PECs. Multi-component PECs is one way for the physicists to produce really big condensates. And mathematically, this is a significant challenge because suddenly you go from a scalar Schrödinger equation to a system of Schrödinger equations. Okay? To a coupled nonlinear system of Schrödinger equations, and this is in mathematical terms and particularly in numerical terms where the simulations really sometimes take you on the limit of what can be done, is pretty ugly. So we need to look into this. We, of course, need to investigate more into vortex dynamics and vortex formation as such. In particular, there's many open mathematical problems improving pattern formation theorems for Bose-Einstein condensates. Actually, a lot of work in this direction has been done for the Ginzburg-Landau equation, but believe me, you cannot take the results from there and transfer them immediately to the Gross-Peter-Jeffsky equation. It's really different. Of course, there is concerns about stability of stationary states. Some work has been done by Yao and colleagues recently on this. Superfluidity. Well, superfluidity has been proven experimentally. What does it mean? It actually means that if you drag an object through this condensate, the object will notice no drag. Numerically, this is a big challenge, because suddenly what you have is Schrödinger equations with near-field boundary conditions. And this is very hard. Yeah? So we are working on this. Then there is many mathematical numerical questions on lattice Bose-Einstein condensates, so that means periodic potentials. What we are interested in, of course, is a complete homogenization theory for the nonlinear Schrödinger equation in this case. Finally, as I said in the beginning, every condensate has thermalized particles, so particles which are not in the condensate. So in the gas, I should be more precise, I should say that in every boson gas, you have, if you are below threshold temperature, you have condensate particles and thermalized particles. To model how they interact, and they do interact actually, you need to couple the Gross-Peter-Yevsky equation to the quantum Boltzmann equation. And the quantum Boltzmann equation as such is a real challenge. Let me just point out that in the theory of the quantum Boltzmann equation, we can so far only prove results for a certain case, namely for the space homogeneous case with radial symmetry under the assumption of unrealistically nice scattering rates. So we are very, very far off target, very, very far off from what the physicists really want to do in this respect. Well, I hope I convinced you that Bose-Einstein condensation is an interesting field for highly oscillatory mathematics. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Okay, we have time for a few questions.
Talking about your dissipative Gross-Peter-Yevsky equation with the recombination losses, how that dissipative term been derived? From what?
Let me, before I answer your question, let me ask a simpler question. The simpler question is, how is the cubic term derived? Well, the cubic term is derived from multiparticle physics by using the Fermi potential, right? And now there is actually a mathematically rigorous derivation for this.
It comes from Heisenberg representations.
There is theorems by Yao and Erdős and people that really prove that you can go from multiparticle physics to Gross-Peter-Yevsky. The question is, of course, much more complicated when you have three body interactions. This term, there are derivations. For example, if you look in the book by Stringari, which are based on physics grounds, but I know of no mathematical justification coming from multiparticle physics.
But even from physical grounds?
Well, there is the equation has been written down. I mean, it depends on, then it's your method of test, what you call a derivation and what you don't. I mean, I found the arguments of Stringari pretty convincing, but again, there's no mathematical proof that I know of. It's a quantum leap from what we have done so far.
I didn't understand what it did in a time direction in Mercury.
What?
Say. In a time direction, and solve the London Schrödinger equation. What Mercury scheme do you use?
Okay, the scheme that we use for most of the simulations is a time-splitting method. Okay, and each of the two equations that you obtain after the splitting can be solved explicitly after appropriate spatial discretization. Okay, so in time, it's only splitting. Okay, there's nothing you have to do otherwise. Of course, I mean, there is many methods for the Schrödinger equation, and I'm by no means opposed to symplectic methods, for example. But this is the method that we have analyzed, and this came basically from the fact that we have seen many computations in the physical and chemical literature which were based on finite difference methods. And they turned out to be very bad, and now we know precisely why they were bad. And the reason is that finite differences are not time transverse invariant. And the spectral method was maybe the most simple method that we could find which keeps time transverse invariant. Yeah.
Did you try to find the multisymplectic structure, or multisymplectic formulation of the problem?
No.
Because this could have given sort of very powerful, not only a numerical method, but a method that keeps this affine transformation.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's of course a very important question, because in the end, as I told you, energy is a conserved quantity. For the Schrödinger equation, it's not the conserved quantity for the numerical scheme that I've written. So I understand perfectly that this has to be worked on. But so far, what we are mainly concerned with is to get the right semi-classical approximations. But this is, of course, something. I mean, the symplectic structure has to be analyzed.
Talking about instability of multiply winded vortices with multiple charge. So you mentioned that they are dynamically unstable for all potentials, really, for to the perturbation in the potential.
I mean, okay. Now, What I showed you is one simulation. Yeah, we did many simulations.
Yeah, so my question is that a rigorous...
Is it a rigorous result? Now, there is... the only rigorous result that I know of is for the Ginzburg-Landau case.
Without potential.
Without potential, but with a far-field boundary condition. Okay? There is a paper by Fang Wanlin and Jack Sheen where they basically pass from the Schrödinger equation without a potential, but without far-field boundary conditions, where they pass from this equation to Eulerian vortex dynamics, and they can prove a theorem on that. And they have some result on stability. Okay, and if I remember correctly, even their proof says that vortices with winding numbers larger than one are unstable. But there is no theorem that I know of when you include potential. It's different world. But if I had to start on this problem now, I would use the methods. I would not use the Ginzburg-Landau method. I would use the methods of Lin and Sheen.
Method of what?
Of Fang Wanlin and Jack Sheen.
Well, if there are no further questions, thank you again.